I guarantee if one of you queens was up here, we'd have better lighting. From the throat, you know, none of this shadowy stuff. My name is Grady O'Hara, and I am an alcoholic. That's okay. I before we started this thing, I looked out and I said, they are going to bring chairs out onto the dance floor. They said, no, it's too much trouble. And I said, I always wanted to talk to a dance floor. It's like, hi there. Great feedback. Well, they say if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you will hear someone else tell your story or the essence of it. And that happened to me for the first time last night in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when Mary talked. And so now I'm going to tell you another story. I've had a whole day to work on it, and I'm tired of the other one anyhow. In this one, I get to be the illegitimate daughter of Sister Ignatia and Dr. Bob. I was standing outside earlier smoking. I had friends, people who really loved me, who offered me Nicorette to get through my own pits. Because I can't remember the last time I did a pitch and not smoked 5 cigarettes, drink 3 gallons of everything, and, you know, a little oral. I noticed Mary drank a lot of water last night. First pitch without smoking, but I'll do better. I can do it. Because, hey, you know why? Because I get to smoke when it's over and she didn't, you know? It's like an alkie, you know? Anybody can quit for a day if they know they get to drink tomorrow, you know? No trick to that shit, you know? On the wagon for 30 days? No problem. 31, I'm out there, you know? I noticed in the book it says, try quitting for a year. And you think, well, you know, that's a little strong. Shit, if you can quit for a year, you can quit forever. Huh. What a dumb idea that would be, right? Unlike most of our crowd, I didn't work my way through chapter 3, you know. Many of us have tried all these things, you know. I don't recall having ever tried any of them. You know, control methods, you know. I had a lover who came up to me a couple of months before I came to AA on a whim, bringing a sick person to AA and not knowing it was me. And she said to me, I really think we drink too much. I think we should cut down and just drink on the weekends. I said, you got a problem? You quit. I like it. Walked away. Too fucking bad. You know, you got a problem. Work it out. I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem with drinking. I had a problem with throwing up. It was absolutely the only part of my drinking I ever tried to control where I puked and when. I never, ever, ever, until I was quite a long time sober, grasped the concept that my body was trying to save my life. You know, it's like when you have the wino shits and you're puking and you can't make, you're making these split-second decisions, you know, up, down, over, you know. You don't think to yourself, I mean, it never occurs to you what a miracle the human body is, you know, and its incredible ability to survive. You think, next time I won't drink. You know, it's bad ice, right? I finally got down to bad ice. So that was all those combinations I'll eat before I drink. You know, before I drink, I'll coat my stomach with olive oil. I've done everything you can imagine. All tastes awful coming up. Doesn't matter what order you do it in. Doesn't matter what you do. If you're a puking drunk, you're a puking drunk, you know. But the controlling was like, I knew I was going to throw up. I just hoped it would be where I planned it. My idea of a good night was, you know, doing it in my own bathroom for long periods of time. I had a carpeted bathroom. I don't have one anymore. I don't need one anymore. I remember I think I was 7 years sober, and I was throwing up. I was leaning over the toilet bowl looking into the calm waters, and you know, you just flushed it, and it's like it didn't happen, you know, and I laid my head against the toilet bowl, and it was cool and refreshing, and I thought back, and I thought, I haven't done this in 7 fucking years. I think I finally really do have the flu, you know? I didn't even know what the flu was. It's just what I had when I called into work. I had the flu, you know, whatever's going around. The pig flu, the swine flu, you know. It was the pig flu, all right. That's... pig, I mean, glutton. I was everything, you know. I couldn't eat it, drink it, or fuck it. I threw it on the ground and walked away, you know. Rub it on, shove it in. I didn't care. It's depository. I always swore if I had 3 hot fudge enemas in a row, I would be addicted for life, you know? But I can gamble now. This is how I look at these things, because I don't want to gamble. You know what I mean? So it's like I can, but I'm afraid to do it for fear I won't be able to later, so I just don't. Must be like being a social drinker. It's like a social drinker, if you are at this stage a social drinker, you don't care about it one way or the other. And, but you know, like, denizens of his mad realm, you know, alcohol could be a problem for people sometimes. Or maybe you have some in your family history, so you just don't do it, because someday it might be a problem, so I just won't do it. But you have, like, this choice. I go to AA meetings, I hear people lying to each other. Oh, I did one whole pitch for an hour on lies you hear in AA meetings, and this is one of them that I believe is a lie that kills, and that is that I used to drink, but I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave me a choice about whether I would drink or not. And I thought, gee, that works really good on the days you don't want to drink. But what are you going to do on the day you want to drink so bad, your teeth are grinding, and you think you're going to die if you don't get it, and you don't care what's going to happen when you do it? It's like you know you're an alcoholic, and you just don't give a shit anymore. You have created such whole chaos in every single area of your life that you will pay any price to get 20 minutes off from what's happening. That's the day I don't want to choose, you know? I'll take grace from God, thank you, you know? I will take a daily reprieve contingent upon my spiritual condition. I will take intervention from a higher power. So I don't keep liquor in my house. I mean, I don't know. I've got it when I came. They said, powerless over alcohol, except when you cook with it. Wine vinegar is different. Somehow we think if we chew it, it doesn't count. You know, I don't know what that is. Funny group we are, though, but how can you cook without wine? Easy. Leave it out. Call a Seventh-day Adventist. They know how. I mean, you know, they can cook without meat. They can cook without anything, you know? But I don't have a choice about drinking today. I'm sober by the grace of God and a higher power. I heard a guy say he was 18 years sober and he went back out. And he had about 6 or 7 years when I met him, which was more than I had. But I still thought I was superior because I hadn't slipped, of course. And he said a little phrase that I never forgot. He said, left to my own devices, I drink. So I decided to put my drinking problem in the hands of another. I put my drinking problem in the hands of God. He's not thirsty. And it dawned on me, you know, very much like Mary last night, I did not, you know, come to right after, you know, just before the Star Spangled Banner and hear about AA on the television, this public service announcement. I didn't sit there one day and say, oh my God, I've got to get to AA. I didn't lose all those things because, well, I know in reality, you can't lose something you never had. Like nobody ever divorced me, but they never asked me to marry him either. I wasn't exactly the kind of motherfucker you took home to mom. I wasn't exactly like doing a big six-pack payoff for a basket of laundry in the house. You know, oh, you iron 3 shirts, you get to drink a beer. Oh, no, not me. I was out there where the action was. I want to see how many of these hearing-impaired interpreters I can burn out. and I look at them, and they're going, and it's like, what did I say? And oh, God, show it to me. I know what it sounds like. What does it look like? I'm so enthralled with myself. Oh. But anyway, where was I? I was coming to AA, wandering through the bars, getting here. But anyway, so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard whatever you hear at your first AA meeting. Mary said she knew in that meeting that she was an alcoholic. I was convinced beyond a doubt that my mother was an alcoholic. I knew I could drink another 10 years and never pay the kind of price I was hearing those people in AA talk about, because, of course, I was in absolute denial of everything. I took the 20 questions home. I read them. I had 6 yeses. I couldn't imagine how anybody could not have at least 6. I Xeroxed it off, gave it to all my friends. We sort of took a group conscience, you know. And there were an amazing number of people who had no yeses. I couldn't believe it. It was, like, inconceivable to me. A year after I was sober, I hadn't drank. You know, I was still sober. Nothing else had happened. I hadn't created any new shit, or not the smelly stuff. No, not the shit you create when you drink. The shit you create when you're sober. I've plenty of that already, but I have a theory about that, too. But anyway, it didn't work out the way I thought it would be, like the Immaculate Conception, you know, like the grace of God made me get cherry grew back, made good decisions and wise choices, and now I will be able to focus on how I can become a saint. And that works maybe 30, 60, 90 days right around in there, and then you start getting bored. So I thought, well, must be serenity, huh? Well, I don't know. We could go to a potluck. We could play bingo. Or we could go fuck a married guy. Something, you know, something. Take the edge off. I mean, like, I came to AA and I went, all right, I'll quit drinking, but I'm never going to have any fun again, and that's that. I knew it. I looked around and I went, I wouldn't even want a full dance card in this crowd, you know? I mean, I'll come, I'll be here, but please don't touch me. I don't need any friends. I have friends, you know. I did for a while. But when you're a militant non-drinker, they don't last for long, especially when you're friends are the kind of friends most alcoholics have, which are friends like them. And so anyway, I knew my mother was an alcoholic, took my 20 questions. I also knew I was exactly like my mother. And that's true, because I was just like my mother. And there was that knowing that if she's an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic too, even though I don't believe it. You know, it was like that. That little logic thing or whatever happens to us. But it's the grace of God that I guess any of us really hear anything that keeps us here. So anyhow, at the end of a year, I took the 20 questions again. I had 17 yeses. And all that happened was I got honest. You know, I got in touch with what was really going on. I did not have blackouts. I wasn't a blackout drinker. I may have had one or two. I don't think so. But my friends have told me of certain things that I did. I don't believe I ever did those things. But, you know, it's like, it must be what a blackout flag. It's like, nah, I didn't do that. And but if you get them over and 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 over, you know, it's just like, oh, I had a blackout? Well, I must have had a good time then. You know, I hear Alfie say that all the time. You get used to it. But I didn't have enough blackouts to get used to it. It was just like I thought they were making stuff up because they didn't like me and they were jealous. And how popular I was. And how many friends I had. And but the fact was that when it said, do you drink in the morning? I had heard the stories in AA about morning drinking. You know, the morning drink? You've heard about that morning drink, the one that goes... So fuck, I just slid my head down and bought me. I guess I drank because I liked it. I don't know. You know, I was like, I drank because I liked it. And it tasted good in my coffee. I mean, you drink $18 bottle of Cure. That is not morning drinking. That's gourmet dining, you know? It's like Tia Maria, I drank a case a month in my morning coffee, but they said, do you drink in the morning? And I thought, well, it doesn't count unless you really need it. How do I know I didn't need it? I never didn't take it, you know? You know, have you ever had the compulsion to drink alcohol? The answer was absolutely not. One more way I'm not like those people in AA. I never had a compulsion to drink. I'm like 2 or 3 years sober, and somebody in a meeting says, in order to have the compulsion to drink alcohol, you have to not drink it. He continued to explain that phrase, because I'm like, I get the question mark face. What does he mean by this? This rings a bell. If every time you think, gee, I'd like a drink, you take one or two, you will never experience a compulsion to drink. Long before you have a compulsion, it just sounds like a hell of a good idea. Oh, we're going to move along. Let's have a couple of beers, okay? You know those friends you used to drink with? If they said, let's go have a couple of drinks, if you thought they meant it, you wouldn't go? The ones that say, I'm starting to feel it? It's time to quit? And you go, why else do you do it? It was really difficult for me because I had a lot of denial and a lot of not understanding what feelings were. I didn't understand what despair was. I didn't understand what resentment was. That's about the Four Horsemen. You know, I read that book and thought, you know, I know why they brought me here. I need to rewrite this sucker, you know. Let's update this mother, you know, denizens of his mad realm. I'm going like, get a grip here. Some of us are a little more sophisticated than that. The revival hour is not going to work here. But sure enough, it's still in there, and we're still laughing about it, and it works. I don't know, you know, what it was that hooked me in the book, but I know what it was that hooked me in AA. And it wasn't the warmth in their eyes and that wonderful feeling of coming home. I mean, this was not my plan, guys. Did anybody come to AA and look around and say, God, I've finally arrived, you know? Talk about low expectations. My mother said I was Black Irish and that my whole life was an expression of the Black Irish prayer. Think the worst first and you're never disappointed. And it's worked out real well for me here. So I could get up and say, well, it'll probably be all shitty. You have a good couple hours. You think, well, I'm on a run here, you know. I don't have 2 or 3 bad days and call it depression. I know what depression is. I know what clinical depression is. I know I was clinically depressed my entire life. I went into therapy and learned some things that I could do about that. The steps didn't work on it. But I stayed sober, depressed. I sat in a lot of AA meetings and heard other lies that people told each other. One of the deadliest I've ever heard in AA is, if I can't be happy, I might as well be drunk. And if that is a condition of your sobriety, you will drink. You will drink. Because nobody's happy all the time. It's just not, the universe wasn't built that way. I don't know why. They wouldn't let me build it. I remember hearing, you know, resentment is the number one killer of alcoholics. Anger is an emotion we can't afford. You know, and then everybody walks around going, well, I can't be mad now. Oh, no, I turned it over. I've forgiven you. I don't care. Then they catch you in the parking lot and run you down with their car. I think what they meant by that is it cannot go denied and not dealt with, but it doesn't mean that we don't get it. We get it. You know, assholes piss me off. Sober. Lots. Not as much as they used to, thank God. Because since I keep hearing in AA that profanity is an expression of rage, I'm going like, well, I could have done that workshop today. Well, I said, you know, well, we're all going to get to watch me be angry because, I mean, maybe I am. I don't know. Can't remember what about. I just, there's a lot back there, though. I'm sure it'll come to me. I was 10 years sober before I had my first nervous breakdown, and I assume that's a laughter of identification and not everybody under 10 years going, oh my God, do I have that to look forward to? Well, another thing pisses me off in AA meetings. Why are you right on schedule? Let me tell you, new people, you do not have to put up with that shit. You know, I fucking hate to be put in a box and categorized. If I'm having a fucking problem, it is unique. It is special. It is mine. And you do not know where I am at. For group therapy. I mean, have I felt patronized or what? Well, I'm a little pissed about that. But, you know, what I've noticed is that to me has been like a really discounting thing that I hear happen a lot. Somebody says, I'm having this experience. Some old timer, which is anybody with more time than you have, turns to you and says, how long have you been sober? Don't answer that question. Because whatever the answer is, they'll go, you're right on schedule. Well, I have 90 days. I have 2 years. Well, it's the second year surrender. It's the third year whatever. Well, you're finally taking the third step, honey. Well, you know, you motherfucker, I took it 7 fucking times. How did you know I didn't take it? Does that piss anybody else off? It's like, some of you don't even know, like, I share in a meeting in San Diego in a workshop. I walk in on Friday, leave on Sunday, and on Saturday or two, somebody knows right where I'm coming from. I don't think so. All I know is where I would be at if I were you, and I'm not you. I am not your life or your experience. I am not the person that you are. And you are who you are as the result of where you've been and what you've experienced and how you've internalized that. And how it has hurt you. I don't know what your pain is. What I could get through, I could sail through like, you know, well, we don't get into that, but I mean, a lot of stuff that I've done that should have, I mean, it would have ruined a better woman, you know? And I just stand up, dust off my skirt, and go, well, they don't need fingerprints, you know, and I was on my way. Got me what I wanted for one day, if only it was to just put off throwing up. I mean, if you do have sex, you can put off throwing up. That's some, in case you go back out, it takes your mind off it, you know, it passes more, you dissipate a little more alcohol, you're too drunk to stand up and dance, might as well lay down, what the hell? It works, you know, sometimes, and which is better than knowing it isn't going to work at all. And but that could be something that could be devastating to someone else, and I don't know that. I can't, I did something, I really... That, you know, I'm really glad I didn't get my way on this one. I have, of course, I have an opinion on absolutely everything, especially your life. I tell people I sponsor, look, when you ask me what I think, you're going to get an opinion. Remember, you're getting the opinion of someone else whose good ideas got her ass into AA with her hand up. Now, my best thinking got me here. Now, you want to know what I think about you. But I'm going to tell you what I think. There was a woman that I sponsored, and I had 3 back alley abortions, and was so grateful to be able to find a place to get them. I was like bribing cab drivers to tell me where to get these abortions, because it was like, I did denial on that too, so it's like, I was like late getting around to this. So it's like, oh, I couldn't be pregnant. I thought abortion was the answer. I didn't even know. I mean, it was years before, obviously, a long time before I ever got sober, had therapy, or understood that I was not a wanted or needed child and was born to people who thought that I should just act right. And, you know, I wasn't a happy kid. And they weren't happy with me. It was a very unhappy idea. The whole incarnation was just a... could have missed it. But it's always been kind of fun, but, you know. Anyhow, a woman that I sponsored who was 35 years old was pregnant, and pregnant with twins. And I told her, get an abortion. I didn't say, how do you feel? I said, what do you think? I just said, get an abortion. I mean, Christ, you're going to... the guy's an asshole. He's been sober 3 months. My opinion. And she just looked at me and said, I can't do that. And I was really glad she was able to do that. I was glad she was sober long enough not to listen to my advice. I was glad she... well, of course, I never told her she couldn't stay sober and do it, because I know you can do anything to stay sober. I just thought it was a bad idea. We went to... you know, we had showers for her. We saw the drill. You know, trying to drag a bunch of sober women to a baby shower is like... it's worse than trying to get people to go to a funeral. I have never seen anything as poorly attended as a shower for a sober woman in AA. I mean, they just send presents in a cab. They don't want to go. I mean, it's like, this is too hard. You know, you're almost pastels. It just isn't going to get it. So anyway, we did all that stuff, and we told her, ha, 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 you know, he'll be going to their graduation in a wheelchair with a handicap ramp. He'll be so fucking old. And, I mean, we really let her have it bad. And about 6 months later, 8 months later, I was in a Sunday morning meeting, and she walked into those babies. And I want to tell you something. I held one of those babies in my arms, and I couldn't let it go. And I looked at her, and I mean, we're talking... beautiful baby here, and you could feel it, that it was alive, so alive and so individual and so perfect. And I thought, if I'd have gotten my way, it would never have been. If I had gotten one of my good ideas across, he never would have been. Who the fuck am I? And when I was called on to talk, I carried her with me. I couldn't put her down, and I was so in touch with my fallibility and my inability to tell anyone else what's right for them. I've never, ever gotten over that experience. I have never advised that anyone get an abortion again. I have never advised anybody against it. I have understood what the word choice means. It's someone else's individual choice. People have to decide that stuff. I can debate abortion forever. I had a hysterectomy when I was 26. Easy for me to talk. It's like these men's out in line with the sun. You know, save the child. Right. You and your wife pony right up here where you give you the next three or four that lady can't feed, you know? It's not anybody else's choice. I understand choice. We have to be able to make choices. And in society, you know, there aren't very many areas where we can do that. I think that... but one of the most wonderful things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we come here, most of us are adults, at least very tall, and somebody told me you have to grow up here. I said, I'm looking for a role model. Show me an adult here. I don't see any. And my mother always used to tell me, act like a lady. She never told me to be one. She told me to act like one, you know, so I'd look around and look at one, and I'd cross my legs like that when I could. Anyhow, so but you come to AA, everybody knows you're not an adult. They don't expect you to act like an adult. They do expect you a lot of times to, like, be quiet during the meeting so that it's not disruptive to others. That's, like, about as far as we go. And then if anybody asks you to leave, after you leave, the entire group attacks the person who asked you to leave. How dare you do that to a newcomer? I am responsible! You know, fine, you throw the asshole out, you know. I go to a group on Friday nights that's in Skid Row, and I love that group, and they get a lot of drugs there. They come out from under the bridge for the coffee. And they're very disruptive in meetings. And they understand that the purpose of the meeting is for the alcoholic who still suffers. But sometimes that's a sober person who brought their ass to a meeting, you know. And we're entitled to have a meeting without disruption. And they have an interesting method, which I will pass along to you. They have, like, tables, and then they have a ring of chairs around the outside. And when the drunk comes in and starts disrupting, they pull a chair out of the line around the outside edge and set it in this island in the middle between the table and the outside chairs and sit him in it alone with no one to talk to. You know how, like, you know, drunks like to talk to somebody? If you've ever been on any kind of teleservice, one of those answering services, you know, in the middle of the night, they always, like, they've run out of people to talk to, and they want to talk. Don't want to get sober, but call AA, those jerks will talk to anybody. And so I watch them do that, and it's, like, amazing how quiet an alcoholic will get, drinking alcoholic will get, when there's, like, nobody to talk to. And then if they disrupt, they quietly ask them to leave, and then they will deal with them after the meeting if they're still around. And the meeting gets to continue in an orderly fashion. But that's about it here. There's not a lot of peer pressure in Alcoholics Anonymous other than to stay sober. People will expect you to stay sober. And no matter how they lie to you about keep coming back and all that, they would rather you just stay. You're a lot less trouble if you just stay. It's a lot less frustrating. We don't have to deal with the fact that we can't fix you. I don't like labels, as I said earlier, and I still don't like them. I don't like adult children of alcoholics. I don't like co-alcoholics. I don't like codependency. I don't like dysfunctional. I don't like none of that shit. If you're fucked up, you're fucked up. You know, I mean... I don't know who they're talking about. You know, it's like, I don't look like one, I don't walk like one, I don't talk like one, unless I'm in drag. Somebody said, I heard the speaker tonight was a man. I said, he'll be in drag. Because Grady, you know, everybody thinks I'm a man. I got him on me, Mr. O'Hara at the office, Mr. Grady O'Hara. I just chuckle. Because I just like being different. I don't give a shit what you call me. But anyway, but what I found is that we get to grow up here, but we get to grow up at our own pace. We don't need everybody to like us here. If it was one message I would carry you tonight, it's like, you don't have to conform to whatever you imagine the expectations of you are in AA. You really don't have to do that. If you can't function where you are, change groups. Don't change yourself. And I don't mean behaviors. There's behaviors we can change. But the internal human being that you are, don't pretend to be someone else. Don't pretend to feel something you don't feel. Don't pretend. Because I believe we stand in our own way with that. I really do. When I was very new, someone, 800 people got a petition together and said, quit swearing. Of course, that's an exaggeration, but I did get a tremendous amount of feedback about the manner in which I communicated what was going on in my life. Like you sit in a meeting on trust and you go, I don't trust none of you motherfuckers! But I looked good while I was saying it. I mean, I didn't look like a woman that would say things like that, but I was definitely a woman that would say, and still am, a woman who would say things like that. I don't feel like that anymore, but I mean, I don't, you know, I do say stuff. So anyway, every year in my evaluation I get, please try and watch your language, and I like crack up, you know, like, well, it's blue, I keep watching it, it's blue. I've heard that before, I'll work on it. I would say, I'll work on it. And I don't say fuck in front of nuns. I do have an amazing amount of control in front of people who I think really matter. I went to Catholic school. I know the matter. But like, you know, if you can get blown out of an AA meeting, you can blow blown out of anywhere. You know what I'm saying? If you're going to not come to AA because somebody swears, you're probably not ready to quit drinking. And there's probably another group where they don't even use styrofoam where you don't have to hear that shit. In the meantime, I'm leaving town tomorrow. I don't fucking care what you think. The interesting thing is, you know, I used to swear at things. You know, people go, oh, you know, Grady, I don't know if everybody's... You know, the program chairman, they know who you are, they invite you to come, and then they say, watch your language. Or, you know, they come and say, well, I'm not sure everyone in the room is ready for your story. I said, well, we'll have a show of hands. And the ones that aren't can leave. I'll be done in an hour, and they can come back. All the, you know... It's like, get out of here. Anyway... But, and then when people say that to me, it's like I feel compelled to do it. It's like, when you see the Bette Midler concert, did you ever see that one where the last thing they say to her on the wings, this is on HBO, because she can't say fuck on regular television, so she's on in the wings and she's all, ooh, ooh, ready to go, and they go, please, please, Bette, don't say fuck. You know, and she runs out and she goes, hey, motherfucker! You know, it's the first thing out of her mouth. And that was me for years. Now it's just the way I talk. So there you are. If it's an expression of rage, pray for me. Yeah. Because it's been keeping me going for a long time. Anyway, my first sponsor, Mary Lake from Honolulu, she's deceased. I would have said her name anyway. I always like that. Well, I can say his name instead. Great. Don't call him. His name's not in the book. And that's at the level of press, radio, and film. Read my lips. Well, I use my last name in AA. God forbid somebody should get a hold of me. But I'm there for you. So anyhow, she told me, I said, well, you know, they keep telling me I have to watch my language and I have to quit talking about this or not talk about that. And she said, don't do it. She said, it will kill you. And she knew me. I think maybe it doesn't kill everybody, you know, but it would have killed me. It was because all my life I had tried to be what I thought they wanted me to be. And I was real tired. Real, real tired. Real suicidal. The kind of suicidal where you don't have a plan. I have found out that can be real serious stuff. When I was, like 18, 19 years old, I told a friend of mine I was going to write a book, Ways I Would Not Kill Myself. It's like, because I had so many friends in psych units, and I thought, you know, they were gravitated to me because they were, I was so strong. It was like, water seeks its own level, you know, Mother used to say. The sick people were drawn to me, I can't imagine why. And, but what I found out when I really started doing something about all this depression stuff and got real tired of being depressed, what my suicidal sort of stuff was like this, it was like, if breathing were not involuntary, I wouldn't be here. Because if I had to decide every day to do this, I would stop. If it were my choice to be alive or dead, I would not be here. You have to have some enthusiasm and energy to kill yourself. It requires a certain amount of motivation that most depressed people do not have. Self-help books won't work. I saw a little comedy bit on television not too long ago, and they said, it was just a bunch of really funny female comedians saying, well, I've read all, you know, 27 books on female dysfunction, men who hate women and women who love them, blah, 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 women love too much, blah, blah, blah. And this last woman said, I've read all 118 self-help books. And she said, obviously, you only know how to be depressed in English. You know, just like, sell out, because it's so true, and all we get is more labels and more ability to say, well, at least I'm not the only one. But we really don't get too much about going forward. You know, buying a book, a tower, would fix us. You know, there'd be a whole lot more bestsellers out there. What we get there, I believe, in those books, and there's nothing wrong with them, is an affirmation and an understanding that maybe we're not alone. But we don't really learn anything that we can go forward with. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous gives us. When I have learned these things about myself in therapy, I have understood that I have a spiritual base and a loving God, a foundation underneath me that allows me to accept this information and go forward. I remember sitting in my therapist's office, and I can remember in the beginning of therapy and saying, you know, are you in touch with how angry you are at your parents? I go, like, I'm not angry at my parents. They did the best they could. Well, 6 months later, I'm like, on it, big time. You motherfuckers did this and they did that and they did. And he said, are you ready to let go of that yet? I said, fuck no. When I'm ready, I'll let go of it. But it's like I have been sober long enough to know you ain't done until you're done. And I have been mad for 42 fucking years, and I wasn't going to let it go in 6 fucking months. My mother had died before I could get even. My dad, you know, it's like, that was another story you don't want to hear. I mean, talk about, and you hear all these stories. Oh, my parents got sober, and my brother got sober, and they're all going to Alana. We had this fall, it was wonderful. I made amends, and everything was smooth and wonderful. Didn't work that way in my house. When my father died of cancer, I hadn't talked to him in 1.5 years because I couldn't take the pain anymore. I thought that long-term sobriety would give you the ability to tolerate almost anything. And what I have found is the longer I'm sober, the less I can take. And I don't mean, you know, somebody hurting my feelings. I mean those deep internal sick relationships that I have nurtured in my life because it's the only way I knew to live, with people for whom I was never enough. And if I was enough on Wednesday, the rules changed by tomorrow. And it's like taking a test every single day in a class you can never pass. And it's just too hard. It's real too hard for me. I can remember reading a book, in fact, a self-help book, which got me in touch with, which was recommended to me by someone in AA. No, it wasn't. I saw it in the Price Club and read the title, and I said, I've been married to that son of a bitch 19 times. It was Men Who Hate Women and Women Who Love Them. And I'd heard myself say, I always married men who hated women. And I was thinking, why do I do that? And it's because my father hated women. And it's the only way I knew to relate to people. And it's just that simple. But I needed to understand that connection. And it helped me a lot in therapy. I'm sitting in like Taco Bell having lunch reading, because I read over my lunch. And I read this little vignette out of this book that was some woman's story. And she was at the dinner table with her parents, her family, and her father attacked her, insulted her in some way, her intelligence or whatever. And she returned the volley and defended herself. And her father told her to leave the table and go to her room. And she went in her room, and her mother came into the room and said to her, now you've really made him mad. Come out here and sit down. Pull yourself together. So she did. Because after all, don't we just want to be accepted? She went out to the table and she took her seat, and then her mother bent over and whispered in her ear, now apologize to him for what you've done. And I burst into tears over a taco. And I'm going, I cannot read this book in public. Because it's too painful. And, you know, that sounds like no big deal to a lot of people. It was a big deal to me. That kind of pain was still going on in my life. That kind of pain was still a part of my life when my father died. I heard a story in AA, thank God for meetings. A man said that he had chaired a meeting, or secretaried a meeting in Santa Clara County. And he had left that meeting. He cleaned up and swept up and put the coffee pots away and went outside to go to his car, and there was a man outside the meeting hall with a baseball bat who had literally beaten him to the ground with a baseball bat. He dragged himself to the car, got home, found out he really didn't have any broken bones, patched himself together and went on. The next week, he went to the meeting and he closed it up and he was going out to his car, and the man was there again with the baseball bat and beat him bad. He couldn't figure out what was going on. This happened 4 weeks in a row. The fifth week, he went to the meeting, he cleaned up the meeting hall, he went outside. The man wasn't there, so he sat down and waited for him. And that's what I did with my family. We talked every Sunday. I called them. It was important that I do this. It was something they expected from me. And I would call to find out what I wasn't doing right this week. Granted, they're in New Mexico, I'm in California. I always manage to keep as many miles between us as possible. That doesn't make a relationship work, but it keeps you from being reminded every day how badly it doesn't work. I will say that just before my father moved back to New Mexico, they had spent almost 1 year across the street from me. And you absolutely knew you had done it. And you knew when all of the company left, you were going to find out what you'd done. Have you ever been raised with Baccarat crystal and antiques and known you could never touch anything? not to touch a thing. You might break something. Everything was more important than you were. You were never allowed to make a mistake. That's the way I was raised. So I came out to that group. That was a joke. I would do it again. I've had people say, well, I'm glad you talked about doing that. Now, I'll never do it. Deny yourself as long as you want. I could no longer pretend to be something that I thought they wanted me to be. I had to accept the fact. Part of accepting me was telling them who I was and taking the chances. And I paid really mightily for that. But there was finally an understanding of what was going on here. I understood the dynamics. It's like, if it hadn't been that, it would have been something else. I mean, my dad was attacking me for being an alcoholic. He was attacking me for being gay. He'd say things to me like, I lay in bed every single night and wonder what I ever did to be punished with a daughter like you. I cry myself to sleep every night and think, I hope you're happy and that you've gotten what you wanted, because you're ruining the last years of my life. I mean, this man said these things to me over and over and over again. So the last conversation I had with him before he got cancer, I was calling him again, ruining another day in my life, and paying the bill, because I didn't want him to think I couldn't afford it. I mean, he used to say stuff to me like, I told him I had a business, I told him I was going to sell. He said, oh my God, do you think you can get a job? I said, gee, I don't know, I'm 45, I've been plugging along here for the last 25, 30 years, somehow keeping body and soul together, you asshole, you know? I mean, talk about rage. It's like, but I heard him say it this time, it wasn't like, well, maybe he's right, maybe I won't be able to get a job. It was like, well, of course I can support myself. I've been supporting myself for years. I can make it without you. And he said, but he said, well, yeah, you've made it, but not without a lot of help from your friends, because they use money as a hook. It works too. And I said, well, you know, Papa, I really appreciate everything you've ever done for me. And the fact is, if it hadn't been for you, I would have made it anyway. It's just that simple. I might not have looked quite as good. And maybe if you hadn't bailed me out, I'd learn my lessons quicker. I don't know. I don't know the answer to those things, but I know I don't have to sit here for the rest of my life trying to be something I'm not because you loaned me $10,000 or paid off a bill for me sometime or gave me a fucking car. I mean, what difference does it make? Is that who I am? Is that how you buy who I am? Is that how you... I mean, you know, it was really hard stuff. So anyway, I said to my dad, look, you sounded like you were having a really good day when I called. You found out it was me. Now you're pissed. And I said, you know, maybe it would be better for you if I just didn't call anymore. And he said, do what you want. And I said, not this time. If you don't want me to call, then you're going to have to tell me not to call. And he said, well, maybe we'd be better off if you didn't. And I'm going to tell you something. I hung up that phone, and it was like a knife through my heart. But it was a real letting go, a real letting go. Don't kid yourself that letting go doesn't hurt. And don't kid yourself that surrender is going to get you what you want. Because, you know, all I ever really wanted was to be enough for those people. All I ever really wanted was for them to love me. Just to look at me and hug me and love me. For whatever I was doing at the time didn't matter. I wanted 5 minutes of unconditional love a week, you know. That would have been fine. They couldn't do that. And I know it's because they didn't get it themselves. I understand you have to learn that. I understand you have to believe that it can happen. I understand you have to experience it. You've got to have it to give it. And you've got to give it away to keep it. And all of those things we learn in AA. And they couldn't do that. But, you know, I can't discount the pain that it caused in my life because somebody treated them like shit 60 years ago. It cannot be my issue. I have to own where I'm at, and I have to make the right choices for myself. So the right choice for myself was to withdraw from that, and it was a very good choice for me. When my father died, he cut me out of his will. Mostly I was pissed about the money because I wanted the money. Bad. I had been planning on that money, and it's like I knew I wasn't going to snag another husband with a good job. I figured, well, that'll croak, I'll get that money, you know. Can't fuck my way to fame and fortune, but I could get born into it, you know. I pissed him off too bad. He left it to his dog and my brother. He always liked men better than women. He cut my sister out of the will, too. He left some money to her kids, but nothing to her. Because she wasn't enough either. And she wasn't even a lesbian. She just wasn't enough all on her own. She's not even an alcoholic. She just married a guy he didn't like and refused to stop you know, refused to pretend she wasn't married to him. You know, you can come, but don't bring him or those children who aren't behaved well enough. They didn't like kids. Get a grip, Grady. Get a clue. They don't like kids. They didn't like you. They don't like hers. They don't like kids. And my mother used to say things to me, you're welcome to come back and be with us at any time until you have children. We've raised ours. We don't want it anymore. And I couldn't get it. You know, I'm 10 years sober and going, but they loved me. Yes, Alice. Have another kid on this pipe, sweetheart. Dream on, you know. But it's what we want, you know. It's that wanting. The thing I love, I guess, the most about Alcoholics Anonymous is I've been able to be unlovable here and stay. I've been able to be unloving here and stay. I've been able to be all those things on the same day. It's like the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is we're just not all sick on the same day. You know, you get to be there for somebody else because you know goddamn good and well in another week you're going to need them to be there for you. It's a lot of times we're not always like totally giving and unselfish. We are responsible, however, to be here for each other. It doesn't have to always be my turn to be there. There is somebody else that can be there. I don't have to be it. I'm not the sponsor or the person in the meeting that has to say the thing to set everything straight, you know, or whatever it is that we think we get into these ego trips. But I can be responsible. Responsible always sounded like such an awful chore to me. It was like, oh my God, you probably need to do that a lot of hours every week. You know, responsible sounds like a job. It sounds like, you know, staying on the same job for long periods of time. It sounds like giving notice when you quit. It sounds like all those hard things, you know. And going over and over, I mean, anything that bores me is hard. And that sounds like responsibility. Boring. And what I have found is that responsible means the ability to respond. Too simple. I got to make it something hard and awful so that when I finally learn that I'm doing it, I can get a gold star, you know. It's like in AA, the only place you can get a standing ovation for doing what you should have been doing all along, you know. It's like, oh, you didn't drink? Far out! You have 30 days! The judge is saying, 30 days? Call me when you got 3 years, asshole. Then we'll talk about your driver's license. You know, they're not impressed with 30 days. But we're impressed. We're real impressed because we know how hard 30 days is. We know how hard it is to even try to get 30 days. We know how hard it is to even entertain the thought of wanting to have 30 days. It's almost easier to stay sober than to want to stay sober. I myself was not overcome with an incredible desire to stop drinking. I didn't have that. I guess I'm sure I have it today. I don't think about it anymore, but what I have is a real memory of why I came and stayed. Because I heard somebody say something in an AA meeting that allowed me to stay. It seemed like a nice enough place. It's really easy to go to AA when you're going for someone else, as Mary can attest. I mean, you just sort of sail in. I didn't drink the day I went to my first meeting because I felt sorry for those of you who couldn't. I knew if you smell liquor on my breath, you'd be envious. And I didn't need to because I took drugs. However, I do not identify myself as a drug addict. I'm not a junkie. I never did street drugs. I never used needles. Of course, nobody ever offered me one. But I would do anything at least once. But anyway, I didn't do illegal drugs. I just took prescriptions. I didn't care whose name was on the prescription. If I was at your house, I would take what you were taking. If I was shacked up with you, I had whatever disorder you had, especially if downers would work on it. I lived with an epileptic, and I used to go into his cabinet and take Dilantin and phenobarbital, and I'd say, I'll leave him enough. If he has a seizure, he'll be okay. Always made sure I didn't take them all. I'm not selfish. So I sailed stoned into my first AA meeting, but smelling better. And what I heard at that meeting was, whatever it takes to make you stay. And I know it wasn't the one thing she said, but I do believe that what she said was very important for this depressed alcoholic. I don't believe there's an alcoholic alive in the world. I'm waiting to meet that person who is afraid to die. Can you frighten an alcoholic with a threat of death? I don't think so. I remember my mother. She was about a year sober, a year and 3 months sober when she died of cirrhosis. The last couple of years were real bad. Cirrhosis isn't pretty. That's not a threat. It's a promise. And she had terrible cramps in her legs all the time. She couldn't keep her electrolytes level. She couldn't drink fluids because she couldn't take drugs for anything because her liver was shot. And she said, the doctor told me if I drank again, I'd die. He did not tell me it was going to take so long and that it would hurt like this. Alcoholics don't want to suffer. We don't care if we die. How many of us thought, well, I'll go out in a car wreck. I'll hit a wall in my red Ferrari. Blaze of glory, right? But nobody thinks, well, it's going to kill me. It'll take 5 years. It'll hurt every day. I'll go in the hospital 18 or 20 times. Maybe I'll be a wet brain. We don't think about that stuff. We just think, dying, so what? To me, it sounded like a reward. It's like, I've finally done enough, I can leave. Call recess, I'm out of here. And I remember I sat on my couch right after I'd been to my AA meeting. And I thought to myself, I'm going to live to be 135 goddamn years old. And every day is going to be like this. Peggy Lee had just hit the charts with Is That All There Is? And I used to drink and cry, Is That All There Is? And that was all there was. I had done it. I had seen it. I had tried it. And even she said in the ultimate rush, suicide. But why bother? Because that too will be a disappointment. And there was that thing in me. You know, I know an alcoholic woman who, you know, she attempted to commit suicide by slashing her wrist, but she sterilized the razor. She didn't want to get an infection, you know? I mean, what if it doesn't work and it hurts? I don't want to hurt, you know? I just don't want to hurt. And I didn't want to hurt. And I really had reached a point worse than pain. I had had a lot of pain, obviously. I certainly sensed a lot of pain in my life and didn't identify it as that, but it was a lot of pain. But I had reached what I call alcoholic utopia. I had reached the point where I had distanced and separated myself from every single loving, caring, sweet thing in my life. I had destroyed every sweet relationship that could have ever been, including the one I was in. We were just on countdown for checkout. We know about that. And what I had done is I had gotten rid of everybody who had any demands on me. I had removed myself and distanced myself from every single thing in my life that I thought could want anything from me that I wasn't going to be enough for. And I didn't hurt anymore. And I didn't feel that pain anymore of not being enough. And what I found out was feeling nothing hurts worse than all the pain in the world. That nature itself abhors a vacuum. There is no such thing as nothing. And the emptiness of feeling nothing inside of me, it was as though my entire being were being caved in on itself. It was the most painful, desperate, lonely feeling I've ever had in my life. But there was no pain attached to it. There was an incredible detachment. Like, you're watching a Betty Davis in black and white. You're watching her do her drama thing, and you're going, yeah, that's really dramatic. But you don't feel anything about it. You're watching it. And it was as though I were watching myself on the end of that couch. And what I heard in that first day meeting was this. This woman said to me and to everybody else that was there, it was a newcomers meeting, she said, if you want to know the reason why you were born, we have that answer for you. If you want to know what the purpose in your life is, we know we have that answer for you. If you want to know why you are here and what the purpose is for your life, all you have to do is not take one drink for one day and no funny cigarettes or drugs, and you will find out the reason why you were born. Now, the sophisticated bar drunk like me would not have ever admitted that I gave a fuck about any of that shit. I really would never have admitted in 1,000 years that I ever asked myself, why was I born? But the truth is, I couldn't figure out what I was here for. I could not figure out what useful purpose I could ever serve. I felt like I was worthless and useless, that I was no longer had any value for anyone. I certainly saw no value in myself. The only value I ever had inside of myself about me was the value other people placed on me. And that was usually what they thought of me at the time, and that was based on what I thought they wanted me to be. You know, it's like, tell me what you want. And then I could never figure out why they never understood what I was feeling or what I wanted from them. But I never told them. I never thought I had a right to want anything. I never knew that I had a right to expect to be accepted for who I was. The thing about having rights, though, is you have to fight for them, you know. And I don't even have that right today. But I can have acceptance and understanding of unconditional love, and I can recognize it when it comes. And I can recognize that it doesn't always come from where I'd want it to come from or where I expect it to come from, but it's always there. There's a man that I love very much in Alcoholics Anonymous who once said, I don't need everybody in AA to love me to make it here. I just need one or two people to accept me for who I am and to love me unconditionally, and I'll be okay. And he said, I've got my one or two, and I know you've got yours too. And I really knew what he was talking about by then. I understood that those people had always been there for me in AA. Not everybody. Everybody that sits here tonight isn't going to love me. My well-being is not conditional upon that. It would be nice. I reserve the right to reject you, of course. But I want you to love me. What I found out is that it really works in this room, too. This is a funny room, huh? Only a gay conference could have enough intelligent, literate people to call this a festive white structure. I read that. I said, that must be that goddamn tent out in the back. It's going to add so much to our event. Yeah, a lot of testy smokers that are starting to pace and walk around and get weird. But do understand that they explained to you in the beginning it's the fire marshal, it isn't them. You know, we don't like to be told what to do except by a higher authority. And he's not here, so don't blame the committee. They didn't do it. But I thought maybe after I talked, I'd see if I couldn't burn this puppy right down. It's a little rebel laugh, not much. But what I found out is that God loves us all absolutely, that I do not have to earn that. I am finally in a relationship for once and for the only time in my entire life from which I can never be rejected, no matter what I do. God loves me. He has to. He doesn't have a vote. Think about it. It's like, did you ask to be born? The classic, I didn't ask to be born. No. You were created without any malice of forethought on your part. Oh, I'll be born. They'll be sorry. I'm coming and you better watch out. You know, this isn't Jesus coming again. This is just us coming around. And so here we are, and I believe that the act of creation is an act of love. It is a miracle. And if God made me, then he has to love me. He can't help it. He made me to be here. He made me to be here like this. Not as you would have me, whoever you are, whoever the you is that day. That's none of you, maybe. Maybe. But it isn't you either. You are not in charge. Guess what? What a concept. You don't have the power in my life today. God made me perfect. You just didn't know perfect looked like this. I believe that God made you exactly the same way. God loves us each unconditionally. Each of us exactly the same amount. He cannot possibly love you more than he loves me. Impossible. He could not love me more than he loves you. even though I do know how to stand up here and not wet my pants for an hour, you know? I don't have any better sobriety than you do. A lot of people, because I talk some, they think, I get calls from recovery house pay phones from people. I heard you talking Palm Springs and I drank again. Help me. Don't drink. Go to meetings. I have no magic. You know, what I can do is I can not wet my pants for an hour. That's it. And I do that, you know, with increasing strain as I grow older. It's like when I get the call now, it means it. It's like, whoops, no sneezing for you. Anyway, I had a guy say to me one time, how come women always, like, cross their legs when they sneeze? I said, I could tell you. Ask June Allison, she's on those ads, right? Depend. But, of course, she doesn't need them. They're for someone else. None of us has a problem. But anyhow, what I know today is that God's love is perfect. It is unconditional. It's always available. All we have to do is see where it is. We seek to improve our conscious contact with God, not to act better so God will notice us. God is watching. God doesn't care what you're doing. He just would like to notice you. He would like to be noticed by you. It isn't a requirement. We can choose God. God cannot decide against us. It's like a door with only a knob on only one side. You know, we can open it or close it ourselves, but he doesn't get a vote. Try and conceive of this. It is so simple. It is so simple. The only thing that changes when I believe in God is me. God's power never changes. It's like gravity. It either is or it isn't. Now, if I don't believe in it, I'm going to hurt myself. If I do believe in it, it's a real good chance I am not going to walk off a 10-story building, you know. But the gravity is going to be the same whether I believe in gravity or not. Now, you want something to meditate on, if you can hold still that long? Think about that one. How many of us believe that God only has power in our life when we believe he does? Well, that's powerlessness on our part, right? Well, I'm powerless, except I'm going to decide there's a God. And I'm going to let him handle these 12 things and see how he does with it. If he does okay, I may give him two or three more, but then again, maybe not. That's not how it works. It could work that way for you if you care to limit it. Be my guest. Another thing I hate in the big book. Very few things I hate in the big book, but a few. One thing is, create a God of your own understanding. Substitute the word limitations. I mean, give yourself a God that's as dumb as you are. It's like, they take me, right, the skeptic of the universe, I'm to come in here and create a God that I can understand. Oh, all right. Well, he's potty trained. We'll start with that. Sometimes he throws up at the wrong time, but I understand that. So I think what I did was the first couple of years I was sober, it's like I created a box that God would fit in. Ever since then, I've been trying to let him out so I had some room to work, you know? We do this. We, you know, borrow mine. He's fucking great, man. He can do stuff. Good stuff. Great stuff. Big stuff. He's making me a new job right now. It may be the one I have, but it's going to have more money in it. Creative visualization, I like that. Anyway, so, well, it's something to do while you're waiting for a raise or whatever, and they're waiting to get fired, which is my attitude. And just another way of changing jobs. You know, many of us don't understand it's okay to quit. It's also okay to look for another job while you still have one, which is a concept that has totally escaped me in my life. I'm one of those alcoholics that operates well under pressure. I don't know that I operate well under pressure, but I'm under pressure so much that I get to operate under it so much that I've become good at it. But what I would say to you is the only time that we are not feeling God's love is when we have placed something between us and a higher power and a loving God, whether it's our intellect or whatever it is. Charles Manson, sitting where he is loved just as much by God as I am. The difference is that I know it and he does not. If this tent were to mysteriously disappear, And we could feel the sun upon each and every one of us as we stood and sat here. Each one of us would receive exactly the same amount of solar energy coming from that universe to us. There would be absolutely no way for anyone to get any more than anybody else. And if you could think of God's love that way, the only person who would not receive the light would be the person who chose to move to a place where it did not shine. Or like me, you know, find a box and put it over your head so you don't have to feel anything good. We can't stand good stuff. And because alcoholics know how to deal with pain, but we do not know how to accept love. If there is anything I would say to you today, remember that God loves you absolutely. If there is a God, He has only one day to work in your life. One day, and that is today. So when you go to bed tonight, don't sit there and pick yourself to death, going over that 10th step and thinking about all the things you didn't do today, because you're real good at that by now, I'm sure. But what you need to do is stop and say, well, if there's a God, then He helped me today. Where was He? And look for God in your life. Where was God today? Was it in the smile of a child? You know, that child I held at that podium that day, I has carried me through a lot of days when I couldn't find God in my life. But I found God in her life that day. You know, it's like I can see God in yours sometimes and not in mine, but that's God. Still, I am a witness to God. God is in my life because I can believe in your miracle on the day I don't believe in mine. And God is always working in my life. I remember Mary said another thing, and I'll end with this, to the great joy of everyone present, I'm sure, especially the smokers and the program chairman. And the dance committee, which is, after all, what we really came to do, was have fun. This recovery shit's boring. Anyway, I called her when I was new, and I was hurt, and I was crushed, and I was upset, and God only knows what it was about. And I think, you know, Jesus, I could have drank over it and then forgotten what it was. What a trump. I've heard that in meetings, too. I couldn't stand it. What was it? I remember. Hard to get things in perspective when you're in pain. And I was really depressed and really upset and really in pain. And she said, God really loves you. I said, I don't get it. I mean, that's bullshit. She said, she always gave me stuff to do because I thought she was pretty infantile, but she treated me like a child. And she said, are there any flowers outside? I lived in Hawaii, so that was sort of a moot question. And I, because they were everywhere, so I went out and I picked the most common flower that lives for one day, a hibiscus. And I brought it in the house. It was right off a tree, off a, growing next to a foam pole right outside. I pull it in. She said, all right. She said, describe the flower to me. So I described the flower to her. And I described the colors in the leaves, and the stamen and the colors and the fluff and the petals and the whole fucking thing, right? Yeah, Mary, right. Here's the goddamn fucking flower, right? Fucking bitch. And she got out of the closet. Oh, sorry, I had a fun goddamn flowers. And she said, is it beautiful? And by this time, I was really, like, pretty much noticing that this is a pretty gorgeous flower. She said, what kind of flower is it? I told her. She said, you know that flower only lives for one day? And, of course, any idiot knows that. So pick all those dead things up off the ground all the time. Goddamn flower only lives one day. You know, that was trash. You know, trash in the making. Every flower was just dirt. And she looked at it and she said, you know, that's bullshit. She said, she always gave me stuff to do because I thought she was pretty infantile, but she treated me like a child. And she said, and certainly a more beautiful one. That God put that flower in your life today to brighten your life. How much energy, how much creative energy must you have given to create that one flower? I said, a lot. She said, if He put it there just for you, how much more do you believe that He loves you, that He loves the simple flower? Because it was given to you to brighten your day and your world. So remember, God loves you more than He loves the flower. And then go look at the flower. And remember, God is working in your life today. You need only open your eyes to see Him. You really are perfect, just the way you are. And I thank you for asking me to come.